we hear from Luke chapter 15. As we do that, let me see. So just a few words by introduction of that. So for the last sermon in this series that we've been looking at, Grace Awakened Encounters with Jesus, we're going to turn again to Luke chapter 15. The first few verses which set the scene, but then the parable that Jesus tells that we know as the prodigal son. We could rename it to lots of things. This series has focused on God's grace as revealed in and by Jesus, in his encounters with Zacchaeus, the thief on the cross, the woman caught in adultery, the woman who touched the hem of Jesus' garment, who has this chronic illness, and last week of the leper. I've sought to emphasize that God's grace is extended to us, and then there's a response to God's grace of a changed life, and that the order is really important. And so today, to conclude this series, I'll speak briefly to the parable. We'll then sing three verses of How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds. If by the end of the service you're able to find the connection between that hymn and the last hymn, you'll get one of Joycelyn's biscuits that are baked over there. So the connection between that hymn and the last one, that will be really good. So we'll offer some reflection on the parable, three verses of How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds. I'll then offer a reflection on the parable by looking at two of the main characters in Victor Hugo's epic novel Les Miserables. And then we'll sing a further three verses of that same hymn. I want to look at each of the responses tended to these two men in that novel. How do they respond to the grace that's shown them? One, Valjean, is to accept it and to live a new life, a life that reflects the grace that he was given and now lives out. The other, Javert, cannot find room in his worldview to accept the grace that dares to renew anyone. We hear from Luke 15.
Today's reading is from Luke 15, 1 to 3, and then from 11 to 32. One day, when many tax collectors and other outcasts came to listen to Jesus, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law started grumbling. "This man welcomes outcasts and even eats with them." So Jesus told them this parable, the lost son. Jesus went on to say, "There was once a man who had two sons. The younger one said to him, 'Father, give me my share of the property now.' So the man divided his property between his two sons. After a few days, the younger son sold his share of the property and left home with the money. He went to a country far away where he wasted his money on reckless living. He spent everything he had. Then a severe famine spread over that country and he was left without a thing. So he went to work for one of the citizens of that country, who sent him out to his farm to take care of his pigs. He wished he could fill himself with the bean pods the pigs ate, but no one gave him anything to eat. At last he came to his senses and said, 'All my father's paid workers have more than they can eat, and here I am about to starve. I will get up and go to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I am no longer fit to be called your son. Treat me as one of your paid workers.' So he got up and started back to his father. He was still a long way from home when his father saw him. His heart was filled with pity and he ran, threw his arms around his son and kissed him. 'Father,' the son said, I have sinned against God and against you. I am no longer fit to be called your son. But the father called to his servants. Hurry, he said. Bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet. Then go and get the prize calf and kill it. And let us celebrate with a feast. For this son of mine was dead, but now he is alive. He was lost, but now he has been found. And so the feasting began. In the meantime, the older son was out in the paddock. On his way back, when he came close to the house, he heard the music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him, "What's going on?" "Your brother has come home," the servant answered, "and your father has killed the prize calf because he got him back safe and sound." The older brother was so angry that he would not go into the house. So the father came out and begged him to come in. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've worked for you like a slave and I have never disobeyed your orders. What have you given me? Not even a goat for me to have a feast with my friends. But this son property on prostitutes, and when he comes home, you kill the prize calf for him." "My son," the father answered, "you are always here with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be happy because your brother was dead, but now he is alive. He was lost, but now he has been found." This is the word of the Lord.
Lord, may the words of my mouth and meditation of our hearts be acceptable to you, O Lord, our rock and redeemer. Amen. I looked at this parable a bit last year, so just a few brief thoughts this morning. And it's really important that we hear verses 1, 2, and 3, because that gives us the reason that Jesus tells these three parables of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. Because Jesus is the Pharisees and the scribes basically, in a sense, say to Jesus, "We don't think you should be hanging out with the people that you're hanging out with, these tax collectors and sinners," which are some of the people that we've heard about over the last 7 weeks. And they started to grumble about that. So Jesus tells this parable. We've got to read those verses to understand the parable. Especially that Jesus is welcoming people and eats with them. And again, remember, to eat with people was a sign of welcome and of joining people. It was a sign of welcome. Okay. There's two parables, the lost sheep and the lost coin, the first two which describe the nature of Jesus' mission, that something lost can't find itself, that it is found by someone who seeks it. That the initiative lies entirely with the one who's seeking. Both the shepherd and the woman go out of their way to find and restore what was lost. And basically picks up on the sense that Jesus' mission was to come to seek and to save the lost. That's the first two parables. The prodigal son parable is similar, but it actually goes a little deeper than that. The focus is slightly somewhere else. The younger son returns and he is interested in being a servant, that my dad will not accept me back as a son. I'm going to go back and my proposal is to be a slave, to be a servant to him. The father will have none of that. In fact, the son doesn't even get his prepared speech finished before the father turns and says to his servants, "Prepare a feast for him." Rembrandt's painting of the prodigal son up there, which is an extraordinary painting, captures this moment of where the father embraces his son. He's reinstated as a son, "Go and get the best robe and put it on my son." It's the Father's grace, his compassion, again, his initiative that goes out to both sons. Again, the order is important, that the Father shows his grace to both of his sons. The older son, who represents the Pharisees and the scribes, refuses to join the celebration and shows that he is lost as much as his brother was lost, though it be in a different way. For this older son understands his relationship with the Father in terms of obligation, duty, and reward, understanding of his relationship with his dad. The father goes out to him, just as he did to the younger son, and invites him into the celebration. And this older son's response is left hanging there. Jesus doesn't say how the son responds. And in a way, what that is saying is that Pharisees and scribes, you need to now respond. How are you going to respond to what I'm doing, the people that I'm meeting with? And these people, are you going to welcome them? Are you going to come and join in? They must decide whether they will accept a kingdom in which God freely welcomes the undeserving and restores them. Let's stand and sing verses 1, 2, and 3 of How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds. Seated. We'll come back to that hymn shortly, and we'll start by singing that verse again. I don't necessarily assume that everyone knows the story of Les Miserables. I suspect that a few of you have seen the musical version of that, which is an extraordinary production, really. And some of you may have read the book. It's a good way to spend about 7 years of your life, reading that. But I actually had, years and years, years ago, I started and got to the first few pages, and oh, crikey, can't do that. Anyway, I came back to it about 10 years ago and made it through, and I'm so glad that I did. It's an extraordinary story. I want to pick up on Jean Valjean and Inspector Javert. Okay, so just a really brief overview first of these two characters in Victor Hugo's novel. Jean Valjean, he's born into poverty. He's imprisoned for stealing some bread so that his sister and child would have something to eat. He's caught. He's spends 19 years in prison, about 5 years for the initial act, but then he tries to escape several times and it blows out to 19 years in this harsh prison, and it makes him a hardened, bitter man. He has this he finally gets his parole, and he goes and he needs to carry a yellow ticket of leave with that wherever he goes, and because people just turn him away. He can't find a place to sleep. He can't find any food. And he finally gets to a village where the same thing happens. And I mentioned last year in a story that he finally curls up on a little bench, and a woman comes along and says to him, "Have you tried that door?" We need to be that woman, folks. We need to be this woman. Because it's the door of the bishop, Bishop Muriel. And Victor Hugo, in the first part of his book, spends page after page after page telling the story of this bishop. We get none of that in the musical. We only get the encounter when he meets that. But it's really important that Victor Hugo does this, because it portrays the bishop, that the act that he does for Jean Valjean is completely natural for the bishop. This is what he's been doing for 20 years, working amongst the poor of France and acting out the grace of God with whoever he would meet and whoever needs it. This is the character of the bishop. He is a man of God, of mercy and compassion. And this woman points to this door and says, "Have you tried that door?" And Valjean goes over there, and the bishop welcomes him in, gives him a bed, gives him food. Valjean steals some of the silverware that night and takes off. The gendarmes capture him, bring him back, and presents him to the bishop. And the bishop says, "Thank you for bringing him back." And he gives him two silver candlesticks and says, "You forgot to take these as well with you, with the other gifts that I gave you." And the gendarmes are just astounded and they have to let him go. And the bishop then says to him, "You must take this moment, this gift, to become a new man. I have bought your soul for God. Now take this and make a new life for yourself." As a convict, Jean Valjean becomes a number, 24601. This number fixes his identity clearly in the past. This number, 24601, fixes his identity and what he had done in the past. In the prison, he becomes this hardened man. It strips him not only of his freedom, but it strips him of his identity, his humanity. And it does so for 20 long years. We can start to see the impact of some of this interaction with the bishop, because at one point the bishop says to him, he calls him brother. "Brother, I have bought your soul for God." No one for over 20 years has probably used anything like that term to him. And it begins to stir him. It's another part of this graceful action, this full of grace action of the bishop toward Jean Valjean. And in this word, he speaks a word of human dignity through grace, a dignity which had been stripped from him. Is this not what we have heard on the lips of Jesus over the last few weeks? "Zacchaeus, you are a son of Abraham. Daughter, your faith has made you well. Daughter." And then as Jesus reaches out his hand and touches a leper whose dignity has been stripped from him all these years. And then in this parable in Luke 15, the younger son's plan is to come back as a slave. But his dad says, "Bring the best robe and put it on my son. This is my son." And to the older son, "We had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead." You see, grace restores. God's grace brings back humanity, it brings back dignity, it brings back worth, it brings back our true identity. As Bono from U2 fame sang about grace, "What once was hurt, what once was friction, what left a mark no longer stings." Grace always comes before transformation. I've said numerous times over the last couple of months that the order is important, and I've said it again this morning. Grace, and then follows a changed life. Jean Valjean's transformation, it's not instant. He leaves the bishop's house after having these two candlesticks given to him, having heard the bishop say, "I've bought your soul for God, brother." And it's going around in his head, and he's really confused by this. And in fact, on the way, he steals a coin from this little boy. And when he realizes what he's done, he's so full of shame. And he realizes that he's at a crossroads. His heart begins to break. His old identity as this hardened convict crashes into the mercy of God. And he knows that he can no longer live as he did before. And he, at that moment, or as part of all this, accepts the grace of God that has been offered to him through the bishop. And he commits to a new life, a life of goodness and mercy. He's reborn, as it were. And from this moment, he lets the grace that he's received reshape every part of his life that follows. This encounter with the bishop and the grace offered to Jean Valjean is Dietrich Bonhoeffer's costly grace that I referred to a few weeks ago. It's costly because it calls us to change, to reshape our lives in the light of Christ, and its grace because it calls us to follow Christ. Inspector Javert is a very different man. He has no room in his life for second chances. He's a man of the law. He resolutely lives life on the premise that once a convict, you are always a convict. And he spends his life trying to track down Jean Valjean after he knows that he's broken his parole. Javert had met Jean Valjean in that prison all those years ago. He was an assistant guard in Toulon, where he sees Jean Valjean day after day. He knows his number, he knows his features, he knows how incredibly strong he is, and he knows that this is prisoner 24601. He pursues Valjean across the years. Once a thief, you're always a thief to Javert. His world is fixed, there's no middle ground, there's no room or possibility for change. To him, justice lies in strict obedience to the law, with no room for ambiguity, no room for grey. He is the older brother in the parable from Luke 15. No place for mercy. There's no place for forgiveness. And if we read between the lines in the older brother's response, in that parable, we might come up with this. He might be saying, "Dad, he might be your son, but he's no brother of mine because of what he's done." The older son was deeply troubled, in fact, offended by the son receives. This is Inspector Javert. What changes for him? Does anything change for him like it did for Valjean? How does he respond to a moment of grace? Because he does receive a moment of grace. Many years later, Javert and Jean Valjean meet up again. Cut a long story short, and it's one of the things about Victor Hugo's novel. He goes, spends page after page talking about the Battle of Waterloo. At one stage, Jean Valjean goes down into the sewers. So what you hear next is page after page about the sewers of Paris. Look, I did skip a couple of pages, I'd have to say. Maybe I might go back and read them sometime. Maybe it's the engineering part of me might come through looking to talk about sewers. I don't know. But they meet up again, and it's in the barricades of the streets in Paris. That's the setting now of these, and the revolution, all that kind of thing. Javert is there infiltrating the student protesters as a spy, and he's discovered. He's tied up and he's told that he will be killed as a spy. Now, Jean Valjean is also there for different reasons, but he's there, and he steps in and says that he will do it. And he takes them out, Jean Valjean leads him out. Javert turns to Valjean, who, with the pistol under his arm, was regarding him in a manner which rendered the words, "You know me too." "Take your revenge," said Javert. Valjean got a clasp knife out of his pocket and opened it. "A knife thrust," exclaimed Javert. "You're quite right, that suits you better." Jean Valjean cut the halter around Javert's neck, then the ropes binding his wrists and ankles. Then, standing upright, he said, "You're free to go." Javert was not easily taken aback, but with all his self-discipline, he could not conceal his amazement. He stared open-mouthed. "I don't suppose I shall leave here alive," Jean Valjean went on, "but you can find me at number 7 Rue de l'Homme Armé." Then a little later, "I find this embarrassing," Javert says to him. "I'd rather that you killed me." He did not notice that he had ceased to address Valjean disrespectfully as "you." "Clear out," said Valjean. What we find happens is that Javert, he has been extended mercy by a convict, someone that he's been pursuing for many, many years, and he cannot handle it. His world, which has no room for mercy, as he has received mercy from a convict, it begins to put him into turmoil. And later on, when they meet up again, he goes to arrest Valjean. Valjean asks to be taken back to his home so he can just attend to a couple of things, and then he will go with Javert. Javert takes him there. Valjean goes inside, and when he looks out, Javert has gone. He has left him there. What we find happening is that Javert is ripped apart by this, that now he is actually starting to show mercy to someone. And it throws him into despair. Hugo goes on to say this: "Javert felt something terrible was penetrating his soul, admiration for a convict, respect for a galley slave. Is that a possible thing? He shuddered at it, yet could not escape from it. In vain he struggled. He was reduced to confess in his inmost heart that this was odious." This consumes Javert. In his world, he cannot accept this. And it destroys him. It destroys him. Javert cannot step into that world, as did Jean Valjean. He cannot accept grace. He cannot accept mercy. He's trapped within his own sense of order and justice, and it consumes him. He cannot find a place to accept such a gift. See, the grace of God draws us into a fullness of life. It draws us into mercy and compassion. It wraps itself around us if we could only open ourselves to this grace found in Jesus. What might this grace look like? How might it be lived out amongst us? Just as I draw things to a close, I want to show just a short 2-minute video, which I hope will appear on the screen here and we'll hear it. This is a bloke called Pete Davies from the UK. He does various things. He likes to reflect quite deeply upon things, and he tells this story of when he experienced what he calls scandalous grace. So just bear with me for a moment while Rosemary and I sort this one.
We ended up in a car crash at 80 miles an hour. We all were intact. Nothing had happened to us. We were so young and naive and stupid that we ditched the car for the night. we got into someone else's car and that we carried on getting high. And I remember going home that night on this summer night, and it was 4 or 5 a.m. by the time I got in, and I remember getting into bed and the sun had started to rise and it was sort of breaking through the half-drawn blinds in my room. And every time I tried to go to sleep, I was convinced that I was going to die. It was the most fragile moment I've ever had in my whole life, in the trauma and the fear of everything that had happened, and I was losing touch with reality. And so, in a moment of total weakness, I ran into my parents' room and I woke them up crying and said, "Will you take me to hospital? Like, I'm dying." And my parents got up and they took me downstairs and they wrapped a duvet around me. They made me a cup of tea and they sat and they prayed with me until I fell asleep. And they didn't ask me any questions and they didn't want to work it all out. They just found their son in a moment of need and fragility and in despair and all of those other things. And they loved me. I think it's Tim Keller who says something like, "To be loved but not known leaves us having some experience of a superficial love. To be known and rejected is our greatest fear, but to be fully known and to be fully loved is a lot like the love of God." I think the bravest thing that we can do is come before Jesus in our nakedness and trust that he won't reject us in that state, but that he will actually move towards us and love us and clothe us and comfort us. There is nothing that God doesn't see and nothing that is going in your life which will serve to him loving you as you bring yourself to him. And that is the scandalous nature of grace. Grace moves towards us in our most broken moments, puts us back together.
You're right from there. Well, let's wrap this up. When we ponder the story of the prodigal son, which is more accurately described as the forgiving, merciful, full of grace father, when we ponder this parable, we realise that we all carry a bit of both of the sons within us, the part that needs forgiveness and the part that struggles to accept the grace offered to us. There are moments when we are the prodigal son longing to come home, and moments when we're the older son stepping back and keeping score. Moments when we are Valjean, hardly believing that God would offer us a new beginning and that God would dare to call us brother, sister, son, daughter. Sometimes we're like Javert, either in regards to ourselves or others around us, where mercy and compassion eludes us. The good news is that the Father keeps coming out to meet both of us, both sons, offering mercy, offering grace. Our response, as we sang earlier, "Forgive our foolish ways, reclothe us in our rightful mind, in purer lives your service find, in deeper reverence praise, in deeper reverence praise." To whom do you need to extend grace this day? In what part of life do you need to receive grace today? And where do you need to let the grace of God change you? We stand to sing verses 3, 4, and 5 of "How Sweet the Name."